This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Cara Levine survived the car accident uninjured 18 years ago, but her husband suffered a serious brain injury and was left with quadriplegia. Carol says when he was released from the hospital, she became a caregiver and not a wife. After 34 years of marriage and 17 years as a caregiver, Carol lost her husband last year. She recently wrote an article for the New York Times Magazine about life after his death. She had joined us on Fresh Air in 1999 to talk about family caregiving. We've invited her back to update her life and her thoughts about how to help family caregivers. Since 1996, she's directed the Families and Healthcare Project for the United Hospital Fund. She's launching a new project which will offer guides and materials for family caregivers. Earlier in her career, she was awarded a MacArthur Fellowship for her work in AIDS policy and ethics. Cara Levine, welcome back to Fresh Air. You've described yourself as having been widowed twice. What do you mean by that?
Well, the first time, Terry, I was widowed in a metaphorical sense when my husband was devastatingly injured in an automobile accident. And the second time I was widowed, in fact, when he died, which was January 1st, 2007. But it felt like being widowed twice.
What parts of him or of your relationship did you feel died after the accident?
Well, because he had a severe traumatic brain injury, the things that died after the accident were his wit, his ability to have a good sense of humor about almost anything that happened, his memory, his sociability, all of those things that made him the dear man I loved. And what was left was a very needy and very often angry man, which was part of what he was before. These things don't come out of nowhere, but it certainly was heightened, and sort of the loss of those other things made the balance so hard to deal with.
If you don't mind my asking, was the self that he became after the accident a person who you still loved?
I did love him, even in that state. It was hard to deal with, but I responded to his need. I saw his deep love for our children, our grandchildren, even though he could not really express it in the way he would have. And love never died. It just got moved over into a different part of my life. And I had to find a new way to express my love for him, which was through caring for him, which I had never anticipated would be the case.
What were some of the needs that you had to take care of?
I had to take care of everything. And when I say everything, I mean everything. Now, I did not provide all of the direct hands-on care. He was essentially quadriplegic in addition to the traumatic brain injury. So I did have home care aides with him during the day when I was at work. But I was the night nurse, as I called myself. So I was responsible for organizing the home care, for paying them, for making sure that all of his needs were met. I became his advocate and his spokesperson, which he had been quite able to do that for himself before, and I had never seen myself in that role. And I did have to learn to manage all of that. It was an all-inclusive and very intense relationship.
I know people who have complained bitterly about how difficult life is taking care of their spouse or their parent, and how there's no time for the things they want to do, and their routine is totally revolving around the sick person. And then after the sick person dies, the person who had been the resentful caregiver feels lost. Feels lost and like, what am I supposed to do now?
I think if you become that kind of intensely involved caregiver, there's no way not to resent some of it. If anyone who says it's a total joy every minute of the day, I think is deluding themselves or deluding you. I kept working, and I believe that working saved my life, basically. Many people would say, well, why are you still working? Well, I had to earn money, one, but I also had to have a life. And I think that is what saved me from the kind of despair that many caregivers fall into.
I remember the previous time when we talked, and this was in the late 90s, you were saying that when your husband got out of the hospital and he was helpless and they were just saying, take him home and deal with it.
Right.
You were basically told that if you wanted to qualify for home health care, that you basically had to quit your job.
Yes.
I mean, for funding for home health care. You had to quit your job, stay home, and do your best to become poor so that you'd qualify. And
right.
that you thought that that was a ridiculous way of doing things. So why would you have had to quit your job, and why did you refuse to do it?
Well, Medicaid, the only publicly funded home care, and it's not 24-hour care mostly, is only available to people who are indigent, and that means really poor. And if you are married to someone, not just living with, but married, that your income counts as the spouse's income. And so the only way I, as a wife, could have been able to have him eligible was to not earn anything and to become eligible for Medicaid, where we would really not even have the level of services that he needed. And I just thought that was not fair. And I was willing to pay my share. I was willing to do something reasonable in terms of, I didn't expect the government to pay for all of it, but I certainly would have wanted a more equitable arrangement. And the advice I was given was both, you know, quit your job, stay home, spend down is the term, get eligible, or divorce him, and then it won't count. But that would have been fraud. And so I said, I don't like either option A or option B. I like option C, which is I continue to work, and I provide the home care for him.
Were you able to at least deduct the home health care expenses?
Some
of
it, yes. Some of it you can deduct. Not all of it, but some. And let me just say, it's not a winning proposition here. And it's very expensive, and it's getting more expensive. And also, I think even now, and this is, you know, 17, 18 years after I started, the workforce is smaller. It's very hard to find competent people to do this job. So that's one of the issues that I think has arisen in the time since we spoke. It's not just your willingness to pay for it. It's finding people who are willing to do the job.
Carol, your husband survived his accident for 17 years.
Yes.
For 17 years, he lived with a traumatic brain injury and as a quadriplegic. For most of those 17 years, your professional issue was home health care policy. I mean, you've been directing for a long time now the Families and Healthcare Project of the United Hospital Fund. What would you like to see done as somebody who's been advocating policies on this front for many years? If you could write the policies yourself, what would you be writing?
Oh, that would be nice. I would first start with changing the so-called unit of care in Medicare and Medicaid from an individual to a family unit. This is the way hospice is organized, and this is the way palliative care is organized. Understanding that a patient or a beneficiary of these regulatory benefits does not exist in a vacuum, and that you have to take account of the family member who is providing most of the care. That means an assessment not just of the patient but of the family caregiver. Is this person able to do this job? Nobody ever asked me, could I do it? What parts of it could I do? What parts of it couldn't I do?
And for example, a part you couldn't do is like lift him.
Right. The parts I couldn't do were the heavy duty, literally the heavy lifting and the constant personal care that he required. I could do many of the things, but I couldn't do them all. Nobody ever asked, do you have any health problems that may interfere with your being able to do this? Do you have other people you're caring for? Do you have a job? I mean, those are things that were sort of basic questions were never asked. It was just assumed that either I would do it or I would find somebody else to do it. And I think caregiver assessment is becoming more common, but it's usually now in the outpatient setting where a caregiver comes in with so much stress and so much burden that they are really paralyzed and unable to go forward. We've done studies that show even when there is formal home care in the home, which is usually a very short period, the family members are providing 3/4 of the care anyway. So they need to be involved. They need to be helped to find ways to do the job in their own way. I remember that, you know, when the few times I had a formal home services after an operation or something like that, the nurse would say things like, well, you have to turn him every 2 hours. Well, that's not possible. You know, no way. It's going to happen. So we have to figure out a way to prevent bed sores without having someone turn him every 2 hours.
Two reasons why that couldn't happen. One is that you were going to be at work, and the other is you weren't strong enough to do it.
I wasn't strong enough to do it, and he wouldn't tolerate it. Those were three reasons why it wouldn't work. So he didn't like that moving around. So, you know, this was not good advice. It's standard nursing advice, but it didn't work. So we had to find another way.
Which was hiring somebody, huh?
Which was partly was hiring somebody, but then I was there at home at night. So I had to find ways to make sure that his skin was intact. I could look at that. I could make sure that there were lotions and all of those other things. And I would say that I'm pretty proud. Over the 17 years he was at home, he never had a skin breakdown. And, you know, that's very rare. But it was just due to constant monitoring. And that was, you know, wasn't due to turning him every 2 hours.
Anything else you'd like to change in the system?
Well, I would certainly like to change the funding so that long-term care is not only going to nursing homes, but is really going to support families and patients in the community. Right now, there's still an imbalance in the institutional bias of Medicare, Medicaid, and to provide some sort of financial support for family caregivers in the middle. Because in the end, it saves the system money if the patient stays at home. So why not help the family do that in a way that doesn't force them into poverty and doesn't lose the productive contributions of so many family caregivers?
If you're just joining us, my guest is Kara Levine. She directs the Families and Healthcare Project of the United Hospital Fund. She's a former MacArthur Fellow. And for 17 years, she took care of her husband at home after he was very seriously injured in a car accident. He had traumatic brain injury and was a quadriplegic after the accident. He died in 2007. Carol, during the 17 years that your husband was transformed and living at home and you were taking care of him, did you ever talk to him about his death, about what he wanted? I mean, what his medical wishes were, how much intervention he wanted, that kind of thing?
Yes. In fact, not only did I talk to him, he talked to me. He would bring this up many, many times and say, he would say in a very serious way, I want to talk about something. I'd say, okay, what is it? I want to talk about dying. I said, okay, what do you want to talk about here? And he was very clear because he had had so many hospitalizations and was so unwilling to undergo any kind of real intervention that he did not want to be hospitalized. He did not want anything feeding tubes or any of those things. So he also talked to me about his funeral or his memorial service, and he was very clear about that. And I felt he mentioned the people he wanted to speak, and I was able to do that and able to get those people. And in his memorial service, I felt as though he were there because this was what he wanted. And so it was very, of course it was sad. It was very sad because he actually died very suddenly. But it was gratifying to hear people talk about him in the way that he knew they would.
Did you ever talk about whether he ever wished he had died instead of surviving with such a compromised mental and physical state?
No, I think my husband had a very realistic outlook on life, very pragmatic. He never wished that he had died. He wished often that it hadn't happened, but that he did try to to find the enjoyment that he could. This did not mean he was happy all the time. He certainly was not. But that the things that made him happy did please him a lot. And those were, as I said, children and grandchildren, watching sports on television. He was a major Giants fan. And having readers come and read to him, and I think that was one of the wonderful things that I was able to do for him, was to hire underemployed actors in New York, and they would come for 2 hours a day and read to him or talk to him and give him that connection with to the outside world that was not me and was not the home care aide, but was something else. And so he took pleasure in little things, but then it was against a background of sadness. So I think he tried to find the best ways that he could to cope, and didn't work all the time. But when it did, he was okay.
I know underemployed actors are not hard to find in New York, but how did you find the people who would come and read to your husband?
Well, I had a first group from the Tisch School of the Arts students, and then went to another setting where a lot of actors live and put up a sign. And, you know, from then one led to the other. And there were, you know, a core group who stayed with him for many years, actually. And they liked it because it was flexible for them. And if they had an audition, it worked out for everyone.
How did your husband die?
He died suddenly of congestive heart failure. And this is something he had experienced before. But in each of those cases, meaning the home care aide and I, had been able to, with the doctor, been able to overcome. And so there were a certain number of techniques that we used. And then this one time on New Year's Eve, it just came very suddenly, very severely, and I was alone with him. And within a few hours, he was dead. So he had had a very good weekend, and it was just a shock. It sounds ironic to say after all these years, but I never expected it to be that way. And so it was as big a shock as if it had happened, you know, without any preparation. It was very traumatic for me and for my family.
During the 17 years that you took care of your husband at home, I'm sure you wondered sometimes what it was going to be like when you came out the other end of that experience. Your husband died a year and a half ago. What's surprising you most about life without him?
How much I miss him and how much I miss the person he was. I hadn't really been able to grieve the loss of that person. And so
the loss of the person he was after the accident.
Exactly. I had become so close to the person he became that I had lost touch with the person he was. And so that's really difficult.
Is his absence allowing you now to become more in touch with the person he was before the accident?
Yes, it is. And I find myself remembering things that I had totally forgotten. And that's very gratifying. And one of the nice things about the Times essay was that many people who knew him many years ago have called me. And so that reminds me of this really wonderful person. But it's also given me a chance to be myself again, which is a good thing.
Kara Levine, thanks so much for talking with us, and all best to you.
Thank you very much, Terry.
Kara Levine is the director of the United Hospital Fund's Families and Healthcare Project. She's preparing to launch a new project, The Next Step in Care, which will offer guides and materials for family caregivers. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross.
A year ago, these cops and lawyers wouldn't dare cross any of you. I mean, what happened?
So what are you proposing?
It's simple. kill the Batman.
That's the late Heath Ledger as the Joker in the new Batman movie, The Dark Knight. The film broke box office records when it opened over the weekend. The Dark Knight is the sequel to the 2005 film Batman Begins, in which a tormented Bruce Wayne learned to channel the rage over his parents' murder by adopting the persona of Batman to clean up Gotham City. The Dark Knight features extravagant sets and dramatic action, but it's the terrifying villain in the movie, the Joker, that's getting the most attention. It was Heath Ledger's final role. He died in January from an overdose of prescription medications. The film is directed and co-written by Christopher Nolan, who directed and co-wrote Batman Begins. Christian Bale returns as Batman. Fresh Air contributor Dave Davies spoke to Nolan and Bale. Dave asked Bale how he was transformed by putting on the Batman suit.
You know, I must admit that I was never a Batman fan. This was the first time when I sat and met with Chris that he presented a Batman that I had an interest in playing. But also for me, with absolute respect to, you know, anybody else who has played Batman in the past, I always felt that I viewed them as a man standing in a rubber suit. And I never could quite buy it. So what I felt was the only way that I personally could make it work is if he truly becomes a beast when he is within the Batman costume. It does make you feel quite invincible. It has such protection on it. You know, you feel like you can achieve great violence very easily. You feel very defended as well and protected by it. And so consequently, you get very aggressive once you're inside of the suit.
You know, Christian Bale, I read that there was a scene, and there are a lot of memorable scenes in this film, and one of them is Batman standing on top the Sears Tower in Chicago at night, utterly erect, looking across the city while the camera shot, I assume, is done by a helicopter circling him. That's really you there, right?
Yeah, that is me. You know, I think, you know, a lot of people have suggested it was a dangerous thing to do. It really wasn't dangerous. I look at it more as an experience rather than a stunt. You know, I know where to draw the line. I have a very stunt double, Buster Reeves, who I'm very happy to let him smash into concrete pillars at 30 miles an hour and to jump five stories onto cars. But when it came to the fighting, which I really think is very much an acting job. Everybody fights so very differently. So I did that all of myself. But something like the Sears Tower was more just an experience that I wanted to have. I don't see in the future I'm going to have many opportunities to stand 110 stories up on the edge of the Sears Tower in the bat suit, looking out over Gotham. And so I wanted to take advantage of that. But, you know, the truth is that they were never going to allow me to plummet 110 stories down to the streets of Chicago. I would have fallen a couple stories and banged into a window and surprised some office workers below. That's why I say it was less of a stunt and more an experience that I didn't want to miss.
What did it feel like?
It felt wonderful, you know. I mean, there's initial slight feelings of vertigo, but surprisingly, within a couple of minutes, I felt absolutely comfortable up there. I was strolling up and down along the ledge. I was kneeling down and looking over the side, and I felt very happy to be there.
The villain here, the Joker, is one of the most memorable characters. Christopher Nolan, it's interesting that we don't see any backstory of the Joker here. You know, in Batman Begins, we see the origins of Batman. And in some earlier versions of the Batman story, particularly the Tim Burton film, you know, a lot of that was devoted to telling us where the Joker came from. Why the choice here to simply present him to us as he is?
Well, when we looked at what we wanted the Joker to be in the film, the real question is who is this icon? When seen through the prism of Batman Begins, we tried to present the world of Gotham as a more realistic world, a grittier world. So when we thought, okay, who's the Joker going to be in that world? He had to be terrifying. He has to be this extraordinary force of pure anarchy, really. And what Heath and I talked about a lot is when you look at characters, great sort of icons of villainy, like you know, Darth Vader or Hannibal Lecter, these guys, really, the more you find out about who they are and where they came from, the less interesting they are and the less threatening they are. That was how we felt. And so we decided, rather than addressing any origin for the Joker, we wanted him to be an absolute. We didn't want to know, you know, who his parents were or what happened to him as a kid and all the rest. And indeed, we sort of riff on that in the film. The Joker kind of mocks the audience's actual desire to know things about people that might explain why they're bad.
And he is a truly memorable, scary character, yeah, as portrayed by Heath Ledger. And, of course, it was after shooting completed for the film that Heath Ledger died tragically in January of this year. And that's, of course, going to be talked about a lot as the film is released. Christopher Nolan, tell us about getting Heath Ledger in the role of the Joker. Did you seek him for that role?
Well, it was one of those unusual things where I'd met Heath three or four times over the years for different projects, and nothing had come of it. but we kept in touch, and he heard we were doing the Joker in the film, and I heard that he might be interested, which was a huge surprise to me. I probably never would have thought about asking him to do it. But he came to me and said he was interested before we even had a script. So we sat and we talked about the touchstones of movies and literature that would inform, you know, the type of character that we would need to create. We talked about, you know, the character of Alex in A Clockwork Orange, for example, things like that. And it became clear to me that he'd really just figured out a way to do this and had the confidence to do it. So I jumped on it immediately. I mean, as I say, before we even had the script finished and signed him up for it. He just had that terrific enthusiasm for it, that great confidence. So, you know, you looked into his eyes and you knew he was going to do something very, very special.
Christopher Nolan, when you look at Heath Ledger's performance in Brokeback Mountain and that deep voice and that sort of very controlled character he played. Mm. And here, the voice is completely different. And the character is so...
The voice is, yeah, everything. I mean that. But that, people sort of asked me at the time when I cast him, what did you see that he had done that made you think he'd be right for the Joker? And the answer was, well, nothing that directly related to the Joker. But what you saw in Brokeback Mountain was an incredibly, as you say, withdrawn performance. It's a performance where nothing is done for the sake of vanity, and nothing is done to open the character to the audience, which is a huge risk for an actor to take. You know, you risk completely alienating the character from the audience. But Heath pulled it off, and that for me was what told me that he would be able to do anything, really. And so when he said he could do the Joker, when he said he could find a way to create an iconic performance that would have its own peculiar rhythm, its own really visual and oral sort of sense, but that would be a human being and a real character. There was no question in my mind he'd be able to do it.
We'll hear more of Dave Davies' interview about the new Batman film with its star Christian Bale and its director and co-writer Christopher Nolan. First, let's hear Heath Ledger as the Joker. In this scene, he's crashed a party Bruce Wayne is giving for the new DA, Harvey Dent, who has promised to clean up Gotham City.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. We are tonight's entertainment.
I only have one question. Where is Harvey Dent? You know where Harvey is? Do you know who he is?
Do you know where I can find Harvey? I need to talk to him about something. Just something little, huh? No. You know, I'll settle for his loved ones.
We're not intimidated by thugs.
You know, you remind me of my father. I hated my father.
Let's get back to the interview Fresh Air contributor Dave Davies recorded with the star of the new Batman film, Christian Bale, and its director and co-writer, Christopher Nolan.
Christopher Nolan, if you could just describe a little bit the look of the Joker character as Heath Ledger plays it. I mean, it's not – well, maybe just describe a little bit how the look came about and whether that's something he developed or something you worked with him on and the characterization.
Well, we developed the look very much as a collaboration between myself and Heath and Lindy Hemming, our costume designer, and John Caglioni, his makeup artist. And we looked at a lot of different references. There was always going to be some kind of punk influence on the guy. I always liked the idea of a sort of grubbiness to him. So with all his wardrobe, we sort of made everything dirty and aged down, as if he slept in his clothes and that kind of thing. We really wanted him to have that slightly smelly feel of someone who's been out on the town all night, you know, and a little ragged around the edges. And I showed Heath a lot of Francis Bacon paintings as reference for the makeup on the face, because I wanted to get that sort of streaky, corrupted feel into the makeup itself. So we realized early on that we'd want actual physical scarring, you know, sort of three-dimensional aspect to what creates the idea of the grin. But then he would have, in some sort of punk fashion, kind of painted on top of that, painted a smile on top of that. And we started off, as far as the creation of the actual makeup look, he started from a point of applying it himself to begin with, just to see what it really would be if he put it on with his hands, just dipping his hands in the makeup and smearing it on and everything. And then his makeup artist, John Caglioni, would sort of work from that and define it and make it textured in the way we wanted. And it sort of degrades through the film as well. I really wanted to get a tactile sense of that character so that when you go in, you know, for a huge close-up, you really, you feel like you can smell his breath.
Right. Christian Bale, you know, the Joker here is such a jarring and unsettling character to witness. Do you think it affected your performance at all? I mean, you don't share that many scenes with him, but did it affect the way you played the character at all?
Yeah, definitely. He you know, is a opponent that Batman has not come across before. You know, if you can find what, you know, the criminal is after, then you have some leverage. And with the Joker, there is nothing. Batman can find nothing. Even his usual kind of fallback, you know, resort to violence, which Batman is, you know, very good at, doesn't work either.
I think the Joker really brings out the rage in the character too. I mean, it was something Christian and I talked about in the first film, was showing, exposing really the rage that drives the creature of Batman, that really elemental thing, that anger that drives him. And I think it's really not until this film that you know, the Joker is able to get under Batman's skin the way he gets under everyone else's skin. And you see in the interrogation scene between, you know, Christian and Heath, I mean, you see this extraordinary anger from the character coming out. And I think Batman in that moment is sort of very frightening. And you're not really, at a certain point, you're not really sure that he's coming across as that heroic a figure. I mean, he's quite terrifying in that scene, I think. And I think only the Joker is able to bring that out in Batman.
You know, Heath Ledger delivers this amazing performance. And then, of course, in January, he died. It was an overdose of prescription medications. And it was, of course, a terrible shock and a loss to you both, I'm sure. But you're also in the middle of, I guess, production of this film, which is, in addition to being a work of art, of course, a big, expensive, high-stakes commercial project, and it must have posed all kinds of difficult questions that you knew you would have to face months hence. I mean, do you limit his performance? Do you change his performance? Do you change the way the film is marketed? I think it's probably hard to get perspective because you're right in the middle of the film itself and in this sort of emotional vortex. And I'm wondering, Christopher Nolan, how you found perspective on how you would deal with his death and the release of this film?
Well, all I can really say about that, to be honest, is that I had a very specific task at the time when Heath died, and that was to finish editing the film. And it was very obvious to me that what I had to do was to finish the film in exactly the way we would have anyway. That's what Heath would have insisted upon, and it's very important that his performance come through in the film exactly the way he intended. So really, that was my task. That's what I've done, and I'm gratified to hear people reacting to the performance in the way that I know he wanted them to.
Any thoughts about that, Christian Bale? I don't know how much you got to know Heath Ledger on the set.
Yeah, I think that this is what he did, and he was a wonderful talent. And this is not a personal journal. This is not a homemade video, which must and should remain private. This is his work, and he intended for this to be seen. And he created an incredible portrayal. He immersed himself into this role. I think contrary to what many people have said, and I think there's been a lot of, frankly, quite rude amateur psychology been going on by a number of journalists. Heath enjoyed playing the Joker immensely. He immersed himself in it, as any good actor does. But the minute the makeup came off, he was Heath, and he was wonderful company.
And the rude commentary you're referring to is this notion that because he played such a tormented character that it might have affected him psychologically in some way that contributed to his death.
I find that disrespectful to Heath's acting ability. He was far beyond that.
You know, one more question about the story here. Christopher Nolan, you know, it's interesting that in this film we see that Bruce Wayne has adopted this character Batman in Batman Begins and has begun fighting crime in Gotham. And then we see that as he succeeds against the criminal element, that they respond in kind and unintended consequences appear. Criminals are replaced by ones that are even, you know, more cynical, more ruthless. And in a way, a chaos emerges which he didn't anticipate. And I wonder if that's not unlike the experience of the American invasion in Iraq, and I wonder if there was anything conscious in that.
Well, not insofar as I think we're all – in the world we live in today, I think one of the biggest threats we feel, one of the most palpable fears is the fear of anarchy, is the fear of the complete breakdown of the systems we live by. And obviously, you know, Iraq is one of the places that we're shown that every night on the news. The truth is that myself and David Goyer and my brother Jonah, when we're working on the story, working on the screenplay, we try not to be conscious, too sort of conscious of trying to put, you know, political parallels of things into the story, because that sort of violates the terms of the storytelling a little bit, violates the terms of the genre. We try and write from the point of view of writing about what genuinely moves us, and we trust that because we all live in the same world, that things will arise from that if we're really sincere about what genuinely moves us. Things will arise that do speak to other people and do speak to them in some way, in some ways about the actual state of the world. But I think if we were ever trying to be, you know, conscious with that, I think you'd feel it in the storytelling, and you'd react against it. So if those things are in there, it's sort of about now when I'm sitting talking to people like yourself who've seen it, you know, objectively, that's when I start to sort of see these kind of parallels and things that we've put in there. But hopefully there's stuff in the movie that resonates, but we try and be a little accidental with that.
Well, Christopher Nolan, Christian Bale, thanks so much for speaking with us.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Christian Bale plays Batman in The Dark Knight. Christopher Nolan directed and co-wrote the film. They spoke with Fresh Air contributor Dave Davies. Coleman Hawkins, one of the first great jazz saxophonists, played in Fletcher Henderson's big band in the 1920s, worked in Europe for a while in the 30s, and mixed it up with young bebop musicians in the 1940s. In the 50s, he made some big band and jam session records and often appeared in informal combinations on live TV. Jazz critic Kevin Whitehead reviews a 1957 album where Hawkins got to pick his own band. Thank you.
Coleman Hawkins on tenor sax from a new reissue, The Hawk Flies High, from 1957. By then he'd been recording for 36 years already, since before King Oliver or Bessie Smith had ever cut a record, or Hawkins had even heard of Louis Armstrong. When Coleman Hawkins started out, he sounded straight out of vaudeville, with a slap-tongue technique stiff as a starch collar. But he was into periodic reinvention way before David Bowie or Madonna. By the 1930s, he developed a sumptuous ballad style, immortalized on his hit, Body and Soul. In the 50s, he changed up again. His tone became harder, more of a roar, to fend off tough young tenors like Sonny Rollins and John Coltrane. Coleman Hawkins never really outran his past. His choice of notes and ear for harmony were always state-of-the-art, but his rhythms could sound a little stodgy compared to his rival Lester Young. Plus, record companies were always after him to record another ballad like Body and Soul. This exasperated Hawkins. I've done hundreds of them. The lush ballad here is David Raxon's Laura. As on Body and Soul, Hawkins barely glances at the melody. Save for drummer Joe Jones, old enough to be Hawk's kid brother, his hand-picked septet is roughly a generation younger, including top bebop trombonist J.J. Johnson and pianist Hank Jones. And then there's trumpeter Idris Suleiman, who on Juicy Fruit plays one of the truly weird recorded solos. It relies on the technique of circular breathing, which lets wind players blow continuously even while taking a breath. Later, it'd be put to good use by innovators like Rahsaan Roland Kirk and Evan Parker. With Suleiman, it's more of a one-note gimmick. But by sheer perverse persistence, it creates a jazz solo so odd it could have been dreamed up by Thomas Pynchon. Idris Suleiman's trick trumpet solo harks back to vaudeville routines, even if circular breathing later became a staple of the avant-garde. That makes him a perfect complement to Coleman Hawkins. One foot in the past, one stepping toward the future.
Kevin Whitehead teaches English and American Studies at the University of Kansas, and he's a jazz columnist for eMusic.com. He reviewed the reissue of Coleman Hawkins' 1957 album, The Hawk Flies High, on the Riverside label.